Good morning. I'd like to thank today's sponsors. We want to thank David and Naomi Kasowitz. Where is David? David is right over here. David and Naomi are sponsoring for the 45th yard site of David's mother, Sarah Leah Bas Harav Shaul, which is in Yud Tes Kislev, obviously a very, very important date in general in the Jewish calendar, in the world of Chassidus, certainly. Over the last year, I had the opportunity of, unfortunately, hearing more about David's mother and very special mishpacha over the last year, and we are the beneficiaries of her and of Gabe Oliver Shalom's work in our community, and it should be l'ilui nishmasa. We also want to we're going to be learning today lirufua shleima min hashamayim of Shlomo Yisrael ben Sarah, Baruch Hashem. There's been a lot of headway, and there's a lot ahead of us. So, Mr. Hashem, we continue to daven, we continue to learn. Refuah Krova, Lavoi. And also, a little bird told me that we have a special birthday in 2 days' time, a very big birthday for Mr. Mail. Where's Mr. Mail? And should be many, many more in Gesund, Mr. Hashem, within time Mishpacha. So without much further ado, this is a topic which has fascinated me, I'm sure it's fascinated many people, and that is the mysterious yeshiva of Shem Ve'Ever. Where were they? Who were they? What were they doing? It's the strangest, call it perennial background subtext to Sefer Bereishis. We hear about it all the time, we read about it, we have no idea what it is, who they were, what were they doing, what were they trying to accomplish. So here's what we're going to do. Let's take a look at the two explicit references that we have. The explicit in meaning to say explicit in the subtext. And then let's try to take a step backwards and try to work out what's really going on over here. And once again, what we're doing, like we did last week, we're going to be moving through some of the thoughts of Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky has a book on the Torah called Emes Liyakov. Of course, Rav Kamenetsky is very much connected to our community because he was the one who sent his son, Rav Binyamin Kamenetsky, out to the five towns way before it was the in thing for the Orthodox community, and a lot of the institutions, including ours, are built on the lap of Rav Binyamin Kamenetsky. So we're sitting in that umbrella. It behooves us to learn the Torah, and the trick about learning the Emes Liyakov, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, is that you can't learn it as little vortlach in specific places. You need to check the footnotes. Because when you see the footnotes, then he links himself to himself, or the authors, his children, link all the pieces together to create a colossal edifice. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to learn through one of those edifices this morning. It is, a jaw-droppingly astounding. So I'm very excited about this. So let's do this. The first place we meet it is we're going to discuss it this related to this week, and we're going to move backwards. We're told the following in Parshas Vayeshev. This is in Bereishis Perek Lamed Zayin. We're at this point in the story, and this is where it all starts. This is where all the problems start. We're told that V'Yisrael Ahav Es Yosef Mikol Banov. Yisrael, Yaakov, loved Yosef more than the rest of the brothers. This is where the roots of all our diversity is going to be found. The terrible saga which is to follow. Why? Why did this all happen? This is the moment you're trying to understand the psychology of favoritism. Says the Torah, Ki ven zekunim loy, because he was a son of elderly. Very hard to understand exactly what that means. But also like a son is pasim, and that's why he gave him this coat. And the brothers, of course, saw this, and the next pasuk says they couldn't speak to him peacefully. They weren't able to bridge that gap of favoritism. So why was it so important to him? Because he was a ben zekunim. What does that mean? Rashi explains three explanations. Rashi says the following in source 2. Ben zekunim loy, shenoylad loy la'es ziknosai. First and most basic explanation is because he was born in Yaakov's old age. And to him, this was his favorite, his youngest, his cutest, whatever you want to say, at this age. Now, what's the trouble with this explanation? Right, there was another Ben Zekunim, right? There was another young, very favorite young man who was Binyamin, who was born a number of years later. So you could say, well, you know what? You know, there was this long gap of Yosef being that favorite child, the youngest child, and then when the new one came on, that's fine, but it was still many years. That seems to be where we're going with over here. We should note that he did love Binyamin too, meaning later on, He was not prepared to part with Binyamin. So Binyamin also had a Ben Zakunim kind of status to him. Fine, that's us, number one. Number two says, and this is where it gets to get, introduces our topic, Unculus Tirgame. So the Aramaic translation suggests the following. Bar Chakim Hu Lei, he was a wise son to Yaakov. Somehow he had more wisdom than the rest of the children. Why? Kol ma shelomad mishem ve'ever mosar loy. Everything that Yaakov himself had learned from the institution of shame and aver, he related to Yosef, his son. Now, as opposed to the rest of the brothers. And finally, just for the sake of conclusion, the third explanation is that Yosef looked a lot more like Yaakov than anybody else. Right, so Yosef was, you know, the spitting image of his dad, and Yaakov felt a great kinship to that son. Fascinating. Okay, so each one of these three explanations deserves its own discussion, but nonetheless, the middle explanation of the Shem Ve'Aver requires a little bit of thought. Because here, already we're seeing that there's something very strange going on. Because it is evident from this Rashi that what he's talking to Yosef is not the same conversation as talking to the rest of the brothers. That's why he's favorite. And he decided to impart to him one specific type of teaching, which the other brothers weren't getting, right? That seems to be obvious from this Rashi. And then the question one has to ask oneself is, so what's the difference? Like, meaning to say, he has another 11 children. And those other 11 children, he's certainly teaching something. Godliness, thoughtfulness, sensitivity to the divine. He's teaching them a lot of what we know as Torah today, but the Torah, as it was in its more cerebral state, was being transferred to them. So what was he teaching Yosef, which was different? It sounds like there's almost two, we'll call it tributaries of Torah here. We have, the Torah that comes from Yaakov's, we'll call it his family, and that which comes outside of the family, which is from Shem Ve'Aver, and Yosef is getting the one. And the question is, why? What's different? Why does Yosef get this? Why don't they get this? Well, how is it different in and of itself? This is where the starting point is really the questions. So in order to get this, we have to ask ourselves the most basic question, that is, well, where did Yaakov get that from? Meaning, so if he has the Torah of his father, then where did this Torah and Shem ever come from? So it happens to be, if we reverse a few parashiyos to parashiyos of Vayetze, here is where it's attributed. We'll take a look in the next source, in source 3. We're told the following. Yaakov is now in quick refuge from his brother Esav. He is now fleeing to Haran to find a wife to escape Esav. And we're told the following. Vayifka b'makom vayolin shom kivo ha-shemesh. He stays in this place. The sun is setting. Vayikach lo me'avneh makom ha-yosim mirashasov. And he takes from the stones of the place, he places them around his head, and he lies vayishkav b'makom ahu, and he goes to sleep in that place. Rashi makes a fascinating diuk. So Rashi is going to now focus on one almost specificity that the pasuk indicates to us, to the exclusion of something else. Rashi says, well, yeah, he did sleep in that place, right? Vayolin shom, he slept in that place, indicating there was another place he did not sleep. Rashi says, where was that other place he did not sleep? That was the yeshiva of Shem Ve'Aver. So apparently there was this interlude. This is fascinating. Here we have Yaakov Avinu being told by his mother and his father to leave now. Leave the place where you're staying. Go find a wife. Go escape. Esav, both are very important reasons to leave. And we seamlessly carry on reading to the point where he has this ladder dream. Right, that's how we the parashios move. We're being told here by Rashi that there was an interlude in between that, in which Yaakov took a detour to the yeshiva of Shem Ve'Aver, and apparently in the yeshiva of Shem Ve'Aver he wasn't sleeping. Right, that's what we're being told. How long was this divergence? 14 years. Right, so it works 14 years. Now the reason we work that out, by the way, is it isn't just like a nice round number. It happens to be that if you do the math, it doesn't work out. Right, we know that Yosef was 17 when he went into exile. We know that he was 30 when he stood before Paro. We know the amount of time that Yaakov was away. We know the correspondences of years. So there's a 14 year gap. That's the problem. I mean, this is all done very carefully in the Gemara. The Gemara does all the math for us. And it comes out that there's 14 years missing. Those 14 years are attributed to the amount of time before Yaakov even heads out to Lavan. And that's the time that he spends in the Yeshiva Shem Ve'Aver. Which is, again, a little strange. Because how old is Yaakov right now? When Yaakov took the brachos, how old is he? 63 is the age we attribute him in within the Okay, so we're all, you know, this is not like, you know, sometimes we have the picture of these young men, right? So he's still a young man, certainly. He lives to well over 100, but he's 63 years old. He's not married at this point in time. And this is when the whole, how old was Asaph at the time? Very good. Excellent. Excellent. Just making sure. So Esav and Yaakov are both 63 years old. Yaakov takes the brachos, he flees. At this point in time, before even going out, he now goes and takes a 14-year break. Now that's, by all accounts, very strange. Because we would assume that in 63 years, let's assume that, you know, he was a late reader. You know what I'm saying? Like, so let's assume that he was starting the Torah. We have at least 5 decades worth of time spent with his father. And we know that he was a Yoshev or Halim. He was a man who spent time in the tent. He was a very studious young man. He spent a lot of time learning. So that means to say that there was something that he wasn't getting at home that he had to go somewhere else for. Right? It's like the gap years, right? What happened? Like, what was bad about the high school at home, right? So apparently something he wasn't getting in the house of Yitzchak. Now Yitzchak was the patriarch, right? Apparently something he wasn't getting there, he needed to go elsewhere for 14 years, which is strange. So the first question is, well, what was that? But number two is even more troubling. And I think this is like something which resonates with us, and it's hard to articulate, is, you know, Yitzchak very clearly says, Yaakov, go to Haran and go marry a wife. Yaakov says, aye, captain, and he walks off to Shem Ve'ever. Like, what's happening over here? How does that work exactly? It's like, you know, dad says, Sonny, I want you to go to the store and I want you to go buy the groceries. Yeah. So what does he do? He goes off to the base of Medrash and starts learning for 6 hours, comes back. You know, there's no time left to cook for Shabbos. Like, is that really Kibbud Avaim? Is that really what he's supposed to be doing right now? The Gemara actually says that he wasn't punished for these 14 years, meaning to say, if you do a tally of the years, Yaakov was away from his father a total of 20 years in the house of Lavan, and now the 2 years traveling on the way back. And for those 22 years, he lost his son for 22 years. But really, he was away for, right, 36 years. Quite those 14 years of Shem Ve'Evesh. The Gemara says, God al Talmud Torah. Talmud Torah is so great that it wasn't taken off the accounts. But like, that wasn't what Yitzchak asked him to do exactly. Right, so why isn't it? And that seems to be like completely at odds with the plan that was set out for him. So there's a lot of issues that we have over here just to try to get a basic understanding of what's going on. So here's how we're going to do it. Let's reverse to the beginning and ask ourselves, who was Shem? Who was Aver? What was unique about their lessons or their outlook on the world? And then why it was necessary for these particular individuals. That's the direction we're going to go. So let's go back to the beginning. Shem, of course, was the son of Noach, fantastic. So we're starting at the very beginning. He was the son of Noach himself. Now, there happens to be a very vociferous debate as to Noach himself. Noach is not, you know, not necessarily whitewashed in the same color, according to many of the Farshim. Here's where we see it. Take a look at this for a brief moment in Source 6. Source 6 says it's a very fascinating thing. This is a Medrash Bereshis Rabba. And what we're going to do is, there are two opinions. There's Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nechemiah. They're usually actually colleagues with each other. They argue on many issues throughout Torah thought. We're going to start on the second line. So this is the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda felt that Noach was an Ish Tzaddik Tamim. He was a righteous person, but a relative Tzaddik. Meaning to say only in the context of generation. Marshal Echad, he gives an example. You have a fellow, Shayaloi Martef Echad Shal Yayin, that he has a wine cellar. He opens up the first barrel, and unfortunately, it waited too long. It was vinegar. Sour. Gone. Shniyakein, the second one, similarly. It was also gone. Shlishis v'matzah koises, he finds another one, and it's now a good-smelling wine. Omrin le koisesu, they say, it's a good one, sir. Omer lohain v'is hachot tav mina, he says, is there a better one in this particular basement? They say, loi, omeru le, loi, they're not. Meaning to say, what is the wine merchant saying? He says, I'll take what I can because I'm going to cut my losses. Right? At this point in time, we know where this particular stock is going. If we see that already, they're all starting to be machmes, they're starting to turn into vinegar, that means that's not good. Let's take what we can and let's get out of here. Right? While we're ahead. So Hashem is looking at his generation and he's seeing, You know, everybody's turning into vinegar. And he says, let's take Noach before even that goes, right? So that's what essentially is happening over here. Is there anybody better? No, we'll go with what we have. That's what Rabbi Yehuda says was Noach. That's what it means, b'darosav. However, Rabbi Nechemiah, as we famously know, says, no, maybe he was objectively good. Take a look at this. Rabbi Nechemiah says, Umar im b'darosav hayatzadik, if he managed to survive the adversity of his own generation, ilu haya b'darosav moshel b'darosav shmuel, achas kama b'kama. Somebody who could do that, could do it any time in the worst generation of history, a generation which God thought was worthy of wiping the floor with, then surely he could have done better elsewhere. How do we know that? His example is the following. Let's say you have a perfumed plate. You have a bowl which contains beautifully smelling perfume. But it's placed in the graveyard. Now, in general, the graveyard is assumed to be a place which has the smell of decay, which is a smell of rot, the smell of end. And still, when you walk down the aisle, you can still smell it. You can still smell that smell. If it didn't have to battle the smell of the graveyard, then surely it would have been even more remarkable. That's what it says. That's what he says. Now, interestingly enough, so Ryaku Kamenetsky points out a very fascinating, like, diokinus. We think about this. What are we describing Noach as, according to Nehemiah's favorable reading of Noach's achievement? He's like a bowl, which is a bowl of perfume, which is covered. Samid pasil is the word the Torah uses for tightly covered, right? Tightly covered. It comes up in Parashas Chukas, where it talks about when you're talking about tuma spreading through an ohel. Let's say there's tuma in a room. It spreads to everything that is open. But if you have something which is somed pasil, which has like a very tight cover on it, then that kli, that vessel, is not susceptible to tumah because the tumah doesn't enter it, at least when you talk about a kli cheres, when you talk about an earthenware vessel which only has usage inside. Okay, that's the way the Torah describes it. So, Zerayaka Kamenetsky, it may be true, but listen to what Rabbi Nechemiah is saying. What was Noach's greatest success? Was that his home was a home where it was somed pasil, it was covered on the outside. It happened to me there was a little bit of a scent. You could smell through it a little bit of this perfume. But that wasn't the greatest achievement of Noach. The greatest achievement of Noach was the fact that it was sealed, that his house was sealed. Meaning to say, think about this. How is it Noach managed to bring up children who didn't go and play at the same play dates as the other folks in town? How did he bring up kids who everybody else was corrupt, anarchy was spreading, moral values were sliding, and Noach has kids who are following the right direction? How did he do that? That's what Noach was doing. That's the beauty of what Noach was able to do, is Tzomit Pasil. The way he explains it, Derech Marshall, is a very, very fascinating way of saying this. The Gemara in Brachos says the following, the next source. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, one of the great Tanaim, says, Afal Pisha Kora Adam, Kriyas Shema Bebesak Neses. Even though a person may read Shema in Shul at Ma'ariv, Mitzvah Lekroisa Al Mitasoi. It is a mitzvah to repeat it on one's bed, meaning kriyas shema l'mita is a separate requirement to that which was said in shul. I already said it tonight. No, that's not enough. And he gives the pasuk, which is a pasuk actually saying kriyas shema l'mita, which is krigzu v'al techta'u, you know, be calm or tremble and don't fear, don't sin. Amru ilmu b'ravavchem amishkavchem v'damusela. Say it on your beds and be still. Meaning you say the last thing we're supposed to do in the day is to say kriyas shema on our beds. So Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, it's interesting. We're supposed to accept the yoke of heaven in the communal setting. That's what we're supposed to do. But don't forget accepting the yoke of heaven when you're outside of the communal setting. What happens when you're at home? What happens in your regular domain? And now you're in charge. That's also a place you need to do Kabbalah or Malchus Shemaim. Don't leave it just for the institution. Don't leave it just for the community. That's what Yehoshua ben Levi is saying. And it needs to be in both. It needs to be in the public and it needs to be in the private. So says Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky homiletically. Noach didn't have the community. Noach had no place he could say, I want to accept God and I want to talk about God, because nobody was interested in listening. You know, Noach, carry on, you build your boat, son. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, you carry on doing that. Nobody was interested in Noach. Noach only had the option of Kriya Shema L'Mita. He only had it where the only place he could actually talk about God was his home, and that's where he succeeded. Shame was the product of a person who was a master educator, not of the world, but of the house. That's what Rabbi Nechemiah is telling us. Now, that's a huge achievement. Okay, you know, we compare him to Avram. Avram Avinu influenced the world. Okay, Noach was the one who managed to keep his children in the fold in the greatest adversity of the generation. That's where shame arrived. That's what shame was about. He was the scion of Noach. Who's Aver? Now, so it happens to be we all turn into autopilot at the end of Parashas Noach because there's a lot of generations there. Like, you know, so-and-so is the son of so-and-so, and nobody ever uses these names anymore, right? So we kind of switch off. But this, it's interesting that in Perek Yud, where there are a lot of generations and name-giving in Source 8, here's where Aver comes. So this is the description in source 8. B'nei Shem, Elam, V'ashur, V'ar, Pachshad, V'lud, V'aram. So Shem has a number of children. Their names are Elam, Ashur, Ar, Pachshad, Lud, and Aram. V'nei Aram. So the children of Aram, Utz, V'chul, V'geser, V'mash. So that's the first son has these children. Ar Pachshad Yolades Sholach Veshelach Yolades Aver. So here we go. So Ar Pachshad, the son of Noach, of Shem, gives birth to Shelach, and Shelach gives birth to Aver. So Aver's relationship to Noach, to Shem is a great grandson, right? So they are great grandsons at this point. It is interesting to notice how the overlap of years works. I have a beautiful book called Midor Dor Lador, written by Rabbi Ephraim Waxman. I don't think it's the same Ephraim Waxman. But it plots all the years of all the characters of what was throughout all of history, and you can see the overlap of just how many decades and centuries people lived over one another. So it's fascinating. They obviously, you know, obviously was a long life they lived together. And the fascinating thing about Aver is the following: Ula Aver Yulad Shnei Bonim. So Aver had two children. Shema Echad Peleg. One of his name was Peleg. Ki v'yomav niflega ha'aretz v'shema chiv yoktan. Why did he have a son called Peleg? Because Peleg means to break away, or right? Pelaga, palga means half, or argument in the Gemara. So it's interesting that he had a child in whose days the earth split. What's he referring to? This is the Dor HaPalaga, the Dor, the generation of the splitting, the generation of where there was this war against God. It seems there was some sort of crusade against God in which God does the Tower of Babel, which God splits up humanity into their different languages. It's fascinating that Shem and Aver are, in a certain sense, the survivors, the spiritual refugees of two generations. Shem is the refugee of the Dor HaMabul, and he lived 100 years before that and through it. And Aver is the spiritual refugee, or the we'll call it the patriarch of the spiritual refugees of the Dor HaPalaga. Just fascinating in terms of being able to maintain posterity and identity in such cases, in such environments. That's who we are. So it is fascinating. Now, so the thesis is the following. If this is the case, if this is the background, the thesis is the following. The Avos came from a different ilk. They were cut from different cloth. The way the Gemara describes it is the following. In the Talmud Bavli, so I'm Yuma Chof Chesam Beis. Now again, these are broad strokes. We could argue on some of this. But meaning to say that one could bring examples where this might be a little different. But the broad strokes are the following. The Gemara says, Avram Avinu Zaken v'yoshev b'yeshiva. Avram Avinu was an elder who spent his time in yeshiva. Meaning to say he was immersed and ensconced in Torah. Shneimar v'Avram Zaken baba yamim. As a quote, suppose Avram was a Zaken coming in days. Yitzchak Avinu yoshev Zaken v'yoshev b'yeshiva haya. Shneimar v'yiki Zaken Yitzchak v'Yaakov. Avinu Zaken Yoshev Yeshiva Haya. So Yaakov, Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov were all Yoshev Yeshiva. By the way, the pasuk quoted on each of these is the word Zaken. How does Zaken tell us about this? I mean, how does the word Zaken give us the inference that they were learning Torah? It could just be, I remember I saw when Tom Hanks turned 60, they asked, you know, how do you do it? He says, just wait. Right? So like, meaning to say, like, so what is it?
It's an acronym.
It's an acronym. Zeh Shekona Chachma, right? So it's actually the way we understand it later on is that it's a person who acquires wisdom. It's not a person who just gets old. It's a person who has lived into their age. They've acquired life wisdom and Torah wisdom. You're right. The great question. I'm not actually 100% sure. And it even says at the end of the Gemara that even Eliezer was considered a person who is Zaken Yoshev Yeshiva. So what Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky argues, and this is a fascinating argument, is that Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov did something quite unique in their generation. Avram Avinu did not go to the big metropolis. Avram was not involved in the big life. What he did was he set up camp in the middle of the desert, and he says, you want to join me? You come to my on my terms. You come to my Eishel. You wash your feet before you enter my place. They had their own environment which they created. Yitzchak did not live in Gerar, right? Wherever they camped, they had their own space. And anybody who wants to interact with them, Avimelech, whoever it is, you come visit me on my terms. This is our camp. In fact, if there was dissent within the camp, let's give an example. So Yishmael, Mitzachek, yeah, right? Yishmael's like, you know, he's got a more broader agenda, right? So Yisara says, out. Right? Means to say, we're going to maintain the purity of what the house of the Avos is supposed to be. This is where God resides. We're going to talk about God in a completely pure environment. We're not going to be, you know, cosmopolitan. We're not going to be multicultural. We're going to talk about God here. That's what, how it is. And by the way, they respected Avraham because of this. When Avraham Avinu came to the Bnei Ches, you know, when they came to Bnei Ches, they say, Nesir Elohim Atah B'Sacheinu, Avraham Avinu, you're the prince in our midst. I mean, they respected him because he was different. It's interesting if you want to contrast this. I heard Rabbi Jonathan Sacks once say this. You contrast this to Lot. Lot goes off and he says, you know, he goes to the, you know, the greatest, you know, capital of everything at the time, Sodom and Amorah, and he settles down, and we know that he was actually Yoshe B'Sharair. He was sitting by the gate, and we know that people sitting at the gate have a certain status in society that refers to, he was a judge. Judges sit at the gate of the city, which means to say that Lot had walked his way up society, up the ranks of society, even though he was the foreigner, he managed to get his way up there. The interesting thing is what happens when push comes to shove, when he starts having visitors and he violates the norms of the society. They say, Echad Baragura, Vayishpat Shofet. Now that he says, look, he came as a foreigner, now he's a judge. Ooh. You see, we've heard that name. We've heard that call before, right? We've heard the call. All these foreign Jews, and suddenly, and they're starting to take rank in society. Ah, they worked their way up because they were kicked out of somewhere else. And no, they still realize. So what happens is Avraham Avinu doesn't do that. Avraham Avinu doesn't go into society. Avraham Avinu creates his own ivory tower, and every on the outside says, "Nesi Elokim Atah B'Sacheinu." And Avraham, you're special. But the interesting thing is that what happens when somebody has to leave that household and interact with the rest of the world? What do they do? Yaakov spent 63 years in the house of Yitzhak. He's lived within the camp in the beautiful surroundings of the Avram and Yitzhak. Where does he go? Well, how does he deal with that? So he needs to speak to the experts. And the experts are people who manage to deal with this. They mean the people who really know what it's like to be knee-deep in the mud of society, the spiritual mud of society, and come out full. And who are they? They are the products of those generations, and those are Shema Ever. Isn't that fascinating? So what Yaakov is doing here, now let's think about this for a moment. Yaakov Avinu is not contravening his father's request. Yaakov Avinu is being told, go and do something. And he takes a detour. That detour is for the need, or for the necessity of that mission. It's like, as an example, it's not like Yitzhak is saying, son, go buy groceries, and he goes and takes a detour. It's like he's saying, you know, son, go buy a kosher, the best kosher lulav and esrog. So what does the boy go do? He goes up and he spends a little bit of time going through the halachas of lulav and esrog, so he is now going to be competent in buying and fulfilling his father's demand. That's what's going on over here. The detour was a necessary step to be able to survive. Go to Lavon. Lavon. You know, go to Charan. You know, like, you know what I'm saying? We know who lives there. Do you know that when he went to Haran, the Medrash describes that when at the wedding ceremony between Yaakov and Rachel, right, everybody was on the same. Everybody knew what was going on, and they all deceived Yaakov. We're talking about a really rotten society, right? I mean, like Nebuch, look, they know what's going to happen, right? And when Yaakov goes out to there, that's when he says, you know, in order to do what my father's bidding, I need to get a sense of what it means to survive in that. So he goes to the Yeshiva of Shem Ve'ever. That's what he was doing, Steve.
The way you describe Avram's house is exactly the way we kind of describe Noah's house, just secluded, which is completely the opposite.
It is interesting. It is interesting. Yeah, so that's one of the questions I have. So Steve's got an excellent point, and that is that, you know, Avram Avinu managed to also survive the generation as well, right? And in fact, he influenced outwards. So he needs to say, but it is interesting. The way what he argues is that something about Avraham Avinu's manner of doing it was separate to Shem. He said he became so disconnected that it created this own silo, its own environment, which was completely separate. That's what he says. And that kind of teaching was not something which was going to help survive the complications of the distorted world outside. Yeah. Okay. So wait. So no, we haven't. What did he learn? We haven't yet talked about what it is. We're going to see an example in a moment, okay? Because here again, this is all very theoretical right now. We're going to see some very specific examples because we have the next step. Now we have an understanding over here. Yes?
Here's the difference between what Avram and Noah did. Avram had a son outside.
Ah, interesting.
How about a sign outside? Noah was not interested in inviting Avram Avinu. Yes, he was secluded. He was on his own. But there was a sign. We welcome guests. We're interested that you should come. You have to come there. You come in on our terms.
Interesting. But that's
different. Noah wasn't interested in law. He was
I know, but that's the opposite. Meaning, say, Noach's, what we're trying to say is that shame and Aver had something to contribute about being within them. Avram had something to contribute about them being among us. That seems to be the difference between the two, the way he's arguing it. But let's go a little further. Let's think about this for a moment. So now Yaakov Avinu has decided that he has a son, and this particular son is his Ben Zakonim. He wants to teach this son about the Torah and Shad Amir. So we have to ask ourselves, what was it about the son? What was it about the son that was special? Right? Meaning, why was Yosef, Mr. Special, that he got all the Torah Shem Ve'Aver? So interestingly enough, let's think about this. Yaakov was a product of being a stranger in a foreign land. And we know, if he's looking back in his history, where would he think that came from? Why would that be? Why would Yaakov be destined to have to leave his land for so long? If Yaakov, from Yaakov's perspective, why?
To prepare his children for the galus that they have to go into?
Okay, well, but even earlier than that, Yaakov doesn't know about galus yet. Yaakov simply is leading his life.
So Avram didn't share his dream?
So it is interesting that Avram even did have a vision. Avram's vision was, in the Bris Ben Abasarim, that Ger Yer Zarecha Be'eretz Lolahem, your children are going to be foreigners in a foreign land. You're gonna now be dispersed. And so Yaakov is now, you can imagine, he spends a lot of time to think about things, right? There's 22 years, maybe 36 years of being out of the home. He has a lot of time to think about that, right? He remembers his father's, the prophecy of his father. What does he think? He thinks?
That it was him.
It's me, right? It's me, Ger Yer Zarecha Be'eretz Lolahem. I am the product of Avram Avinu's prophecy, right? When does it end? What was the statute of limitation in that prophecy?
Four generations.
V'dor Avi Yoshevuhena, the fourth generation returns here. Who's the fourth generation? It goes, Avram is the first generation. Second one is Yitzhak. Third one is Yaakov. Fourth generation is? His child. Who's the child who he believes is going to be his scion? The child of Rachel. Who's the eldest child of Rachel? Yosef. When does Yaakov go back? When does Yaakov know it's time to return to the land upon the birth of Yosef, Rashi says. Rashi quotes the pasuk in Avadia, which talks about how Yosef is going to be the spark which links the fire and the kash and the hay. Yosef is going to be, in a certain sense, the catalyst for return. Yaakov, in a certain sense, on a microcosmic level, believes that the Bris Ben Abasarim essentially has happened with him. It is now the return. It is fascinating. Rabbi Foreman points this out in an incredible way. If you actually follow the return of Yaakov to the land of Israel, there are numerous parallels to the exit of Israel, the exodus of Israel from Egypt. You know that 7 days, that 7 days experience of Lavan chasing them, the 7 days between Israel and the Kriyas Yamsuf, the exact parallel of what was going on in terms of pursuit. The first place they settled down is Sukkos, the place of Sukkos, which applies in both places. Different Sukkos, interestingly enough. Yaakov arrives at a place called Sukkos, and Bnei Yisrael's first stop after passing Ramses was a place called Sukkos. There are numerous parallels, because in a certain sense, Yaakov is living the microcosm of the macrocosm of what would later be on the Exodus. Fascinating enough. So it's interesting.
Is that why the name Israel is being used in that Yaakov when he talks?
Not sure. There's more to it. Possibly, again, there's two times he's named Yisrael, so it's more complex, because there's the angel and there's later on Hashem. Yes, exactly. So this is, of course, why it is that when we talk about Egypt, we always bring Lavan back into it. Like, what has Lavan got to do with Egypt? Why is it Arami Aved Avi? Because apparently Lavan was, in a certain sense, the smaller cycle of the bigger cycle. This also, by the way, gives us a much more tragic perspective of what the beginning of this week's parasha is. It says, Vayeshev Yaakov. Yaakov, settled down. Rashi says, Bikesh Yaakov Leishev B'Shalva. Yaakov wanted to sit down and relax. Why did he want to relax? What did he think just happened? He just thought that he's finished the cycle of Bris Ben Abasarim. Then what happens, says Rashi? Kofat Zalav, Rugzo Shol Yosef. What happens is suddenly the Yosef episode starts. What's happening over here? Yaakov, you think you're finished? It's just beginning. The microcosm closed, the macrocosm opens. That's what's really happening. That's what Vayeshev is the two cycles meeting each other. Fascinating, right? But interestingly enough, Yaakov in some way understood that Yosef was this pivotal character who's going to be the one who bridges the worlds. He's the one who's going to have to go out there. He doesn't know why. He's not clear how, but he knows that Yosef is going to be different to the rest of the brothers. He's going to be this person who's going to survive. And so he teaches him the Torah and Sheva Eber. Was he correct? The answer is absolutely. Yosef was the one who had to go out there. Yosef was the one who had to survive in adversity. That's who Yosef was. That's why Yaakov felt that it was him, the seat of, or his scion in a certain sense, who had to be the one to go out there. Does it work? The answer is fantastically. Examples are Yosef's challenge. Yosef, the Apostle tells us in Source 16, Yosef is quietly returning to the house. Mrs. Potiphar is the only one around. Everybody else is out of festival. And he returns to the house. And she grabs his clothing. And she seduces him. And he leaves his clothing in her hands and runs out. Rashi says, what does it mean that he was going to the house to do his work? Rashi tells us, Rav Ushmuel, there's actually a debate as to what was going on. Chadam Malachto Mamash, one says that he was actually going to do his work, meaning to say he was going to just make sure that the front hall was swept. V'chad Omer La'asos Tzrochov Imo. Right? What that means to say that he's actually broken. He was going to meet her. He'd finally, after day in, day out, nobody's around, he was going to actually meet Ashes Potiphar. Then what happened? Also, Elo, Shenireis Loidimus Dinukoshil Aviv. What stopped him? Suddenly the vision of his father appeared in front of him. Now, one has to imagine, somehow that carryover, that vision of his father, what stopped him? I wonder if this is actually the place where it is that that Yaakov Avinu is able to remember. He's remembering what his father taught him, what it means to live in a culture which is completely opposite to you. That's what stopped him, specifically that image of his father. Interestingly enough, actually, just... As a quick footnote over here, I skipped this out beforehand. The other place that shame appears beforehand, just in this whole thing, is when Rivka is having childbirth issues and she's having a terrible pregnancy. It says Vatelech Lidrosh Hashem. She went to search out God. Rashi tells us who's God. It means to say in the mouth of shame. Why shame? Apparently, she couldn't get the answers in the house of Yitzchak. Isn't that interesting? Apparently, Abraham and Isaac weren't capable of answering the complexity of an Esav. Isn't that interesting? Just to appreciate why she had to go outwards to shame to appreciate what was really going on in terms of the Esav character. That's just a fascinating another nuance within the shame. One thing I'm still working on, I'm not sure I'm there yet, just as a side note, is Malkitzedek. Right, so I've not found anything tenable yet on why Malkitzedek and the uniqueness of Malkitzedek over there when he meets Avram earlier on, but still the jury is out trying to find it. It'd be very fascinating to hear thoughts. Nonetheless, returning to Yosef, Yosef succeeds on a personal level. Yosef also succeeds on a national level. We're told in Source 18, "Vayomer Yisrael, Rav od Yosef benichai, elcho ve'erenu b'terem amus." He says, it is so much that my son is still alive. I have to go see him before I die. This is when he finds out that Yosef is alive. The whole episode is now closing. What actually happens? So the Midrash tells us that it was almost as if it was too much for him. It was almost as if he said, not only is he alive, but that he is doing what he is supposed to be doing. Meaning to say that it's not just that he survived physically. From what I'm hearing, it sounds like he survived spiritually. And Yaakov Avinu then realizes that everything I did succeeded. That what I taught him managed to keep him up. The way Hashem turns to him is the following. Take a look in Source. Oh, I wonder where I put it. It's over here. Yeah, Source 19. Hashem says to Yaakov, don't worry. You're going down to Mitzrayim. You know that this is the macrocosm of Golos. Don't worry. You're going down to Egypt. I'm going to make you into a great nation. I'm going with you. I'm going to come out with you. Yosef's going to cover your eyes. And what Rashi says is he's going to do Kriya Shema. He's going to protect you. How did that happen? Meaning like, why was Yosef the person who's going to protect him? Because Yosef understood what it's like to be in Mitzrayim. He says, don't worry. You have somebody you taught how to deal with foreign societies, what it means to be in the depths of that society. Yosef's going to look after you. How does Yosef look after them? Yosef takes two measures, fascinating measures. Number one is he separates them. He places them in their own place called Goshen, which means to say, although he understands that he can survive in those kind of societies, he says, I'm going to make sure that Israel is separate. Right? It's interesting. The Torah of Shem Ve'ever understands the necessity for the Torah of the Avos. Is that interesting? Usually you find that certain ideologies exclude all other ideologies. We see it today in politics. I mean, you say there is no space for conversation anymore, right? Yeah. So there is a space for conversation. He also understands the need for separation. But then it becomes even more fascinating. Listen to this. This to me is remarkable. We most often miss this part of the Torah. Take a look at Yosef's policy section. This is in the last source here on the bottom of page 5. Here is a section at the end of Parshas Vayigash. Everybody's come to Mitzrayim, everybody's happy, and we're about to live happily ever after, sort of, for the moment. And then we hear this section. Vayoshev Yosef esaviv esecho v'yitin lohem eretz lohem achuzah be'eretz Mitzrayim v'meitav ha'oretz be'eretz Ramses kasher tzivo paro. So he settles everybody in the land of Ramses, which is as Pharaoh commanded. Now, if we skip to the very, very end of this section. Okay, so let's just flip to the very, very end. The last pasuk, which is the last pasuk of Parshas Vayigash. Vayeshev Yisrael be'eretz Mitzrayim, be'eretz Goshen, ve'achazu bo, vayifru, vayirbo mo'od. They live in the land of Mitzrayim, in the land of Goshen, and they expand exponentially. So, in a certain sense, those two psukim are really, should be consecutive psukim, right? He settles them down, they succeed, right? That's what the psukim are telling us. What is fascinating is the interlude of the psukim in between. Apparently, wedged between the description of how he settles down his family and how they succeed is that now we're going to now diverge. We're going to now start talking about national policy in Egypt at the time, which is fascinating. So we have to ask ourselves, what does national policy have to do with Israel surviving? Let's take a look at the national policy for a second. Here we go. Let's go back to Pasuk Yud Beis, Pasuk 12 in Source 5. He gives already food. There simply is no food left. So everything is languishing in the famine. So Yosef now becomes in control of all of the money of all of Egypt, right? And it goes to the king's coffers because at this point in time, people need, in the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, we need security and, you know, sustenance at the very bottom. They will spend all their money buying food. So what happens? There simply is no longer currency. Inflation is too high. Meretz Canaan, even from the neighboring countries, vayavo kol Mitzrayim el Yosef lemor, havlanu lechem v'lama nomus negdecha ki ofes kesef. So they said, we're going to die. What are we going to? We can't. We don't have anything left to pay you. What are we going to do? So Yosef says, Yom Yosef, havu miknechem v'etno lachem b'miknechem im ofes kesef. Don't worry, I'll reacquisition your assets. Okay, you're no longer called currency. I'll take what you own. So he takes all their livestock. That year, everybody buys based on their on their possessions. But there's nothing. There's not a single bear at home left, right? There's no livestock. All we have is ourselves and our real estate. Why should we die? We will sell ourselves to the crown. Can you imagine this? I mean, has this ever happened in society? This Yosef is the most powerful man. Think what's going on over here. They're offering themselves as slaves for their own survival. Right? Vayiken Yosef is called Admas Mitzrayim leFaro. So he acquires all of the real estate in all of Egypt. Right? Forget socialist society. This is crown-owned society. Ki chozak aleim harav atiyah haaretz leFaro. Everything is owned by the government. What does he do? He starts now urbanizing. He starts shifting people where they live. Miksegvul Mitzrayim akotzeyu. From one side to the other. Rak Admas akwanim loikona. Interesting. He makes a legal loophole. He doesn't acquire the land of the priests. He makes a law in the name of Pharaoh that the priest's land doesn't go. He doesn't sell their land. He leaves the priests to eat on the budget of the government. So now I'm going to give you government-owned seed. because I own all the seeds because of the storehouses. Go and now plant my land. Right, and now everything you're planting, a fifth is going to belong to the government. He says, don't worry, he's making an arrangement. Basically, the government's getting their cut, you can have your food. And that is the way it was, and that was the way that the law continued. So you see an interesting thing over here. And then we go return to our family description. It's fascinating. We have an interruption between settling his family and then national policy. This is the kind of part we miss out in Vayigash. It's always really going on in society around us. Why is this relevant? Why is this relevant to the settling of Israel? So Yaakov Kamenetsky says the first thing is important, is that sometimes that in all there's a danger to the foreigner, to the person who's the newcomer into society, because everybody says, you're the newcomer. You're not going to succeed. They make it very difficult for the newcomer. So what does he do? Yosef acquires all of Egypt. And what does he do? He starts shifting people around. Nobody's living in their place. Nobody is the old money anymore. There's no old money. There's no old assets. There's no real estate. Yosef shifts up all of society. Why? Because into the society they walk into is a society where there's no sense of domain, no sense of, we'll call it, the identity with the land. Yosef has made it much easier for them to now also be unusual in the sense that they don't have their own space. He does more than that. He also taxes everybody except the priests. Now, the priests he's talking about are not Jewish priests. He's talking about, you know, people who spend time in the pantheon of Ra, right? We're talking about Egyptian gods over here. So what's going on? What's interesting is he's setting up the legal framework for the land so that in a few generations' time, when there are going to be other people who are enslaved to the crown, and those people are called the Hebrews, their priests, based on the books, are not going to be taxed. Who are the priests of the nation of the Hebrews? They're the Levium. The reason why there was only a spiritual bastion left for Israel was because of the legal framework created by a person by the name of Sophnas Paneach in the books of Egypt's law. Is that fascinating? Says Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, if you think about this, Yosef was not just a leader. Yosef was a visionary. Where did he get that from? He got that from people of the past generations who knew how to survive in very adverse circumstances, which his father taught him, knowing that he would go into the depths of Egypt. And that's the reason why we survived the second cycle of Golus. Not the Golus that Yaakov went through, but the Golus that Yosef started and succeeded through. This is the story of the mysterious Yeshiva Sheva Eri. Thank you very much. Rabbi Nachman Akasha, Rabbi Yadir.